That was a little bit of Ostinato Suite for Angela from Herbie Hancock's album One Dishi, performed by the band of the same name. So that was Eddie Henderson on trumpet, Benny Maupin on bass clarinet, Julian Priester on trombone, Hancock on Fender Rhodes, Buster Williams on bass, and Billy Hart on drums. Buster Williams is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello. I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to episode 20 of the Burning Ambulance podcast. If this is your first time listening, welcome. And if you're a long-time listener, welcome back. You can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, and on lots of other podcast aggregators, I'm sure. And if you like the show, I hope you'll consider giving us a review or a star rating on iTunes. And if you really like the show, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. The show is part of the OSIRIS Podcast Network, a collection of over two dozen podcasts on subjects ranging from music to craft brewing to parenthood to arts and literature. If you visit osirispod.com, you can look through all their other shows and see if any of those are of interest to you. And OSIRIS is a partner of Relix Magazine, so visit relix.com for music news and other stuff. Buster Williams is a jazz MVP like very few others. He got his start in the late 50s, and he's been on literally hundreds of records. When I was researching this interview, I was going through his catalog on Discogs, and as you'll hear, there are a whole bunch of albums he did in the 60s that they don't even have listed there. He's played with everybody. He was with Miles Davis, he was with Art Blakey, he was with Herbie Hancock, the Jazz Crusaders, and a bunch of different singers. He's played bass on so many records, he's even on some where a different bassist is the leader. He's done a couple of records like that with Ron Carter. He doesn't record very often as a leader, but when he does, the music is fantastic. The reason he stays in the back is he really views his role as a supportive member of the ensemble to be crucial. He's trying to provide a bottom end and feed harmonies to the horns and the piano, and especially to a singer. What he has to say about working with singers in this interview really fascinated me, and I hope you'll find it as interesting as I did. I'm going to be honest, I really feel like I learned a tremendous amount about how jazz works by talking to Buster Williams. I can't read music, I can't really play any instruments, but what he has to say about how he thinks a group should work together and what his role is, I found extremely enlightening, and it's probably going to change the way I listen going forward. I'm very excited for you to hear our conversation. Before that, though, I'm going to play one more piece of music. This is Lost on Fourth Avenue from his new album Audacity, with Steve Wilson on saxophone, George Culligan on piano, and Lenny White on drums. This piece begins with a bass solo, which is not that common in his discography because, as I said, he really works hard to be an accompanist and a foundation. So check that out, and then you'll hear my interview with Buster Williams. Thank you.
You've got this new album out, or coming out in a couple of days, with Steve Wilson, George Colligan, and Lenny White. How long has that group been together?
That group has been together. Actually, it says so in the liner notes. My piano player, George Colligan, actually did the liner notes. I think we've been together about 15, 17 years, something like that.
Wow. Yeah. And this is the second album that you did with that lineup, right? Because you guys did an album of Herbie Hancock tunes in about 2008.
Well, that was, yeah, but no. This group, we did an album where we did Griot Liberté.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see, who's on Griot Liberté? George is on that. But, okay. The album that you're talking about was George Colligan album. And we did that year. When was that? I forget what year that was.
2008, but that one was under Colligan's name?
That was under Colligan's name, yeah.
Okay, okay.
And we did Griot Liberté, I think, 2006 or something like that.
Yeah, 2004. 2004. Yeah, but Steve Wilson wasn't on that record. It was you, George, and Lenny.
Who was playing?
And I think it was some, I don't remember who was playing sax or, you know. But
it must have been, Stefan Harris.
That's right, yeah.
Vibes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, what do you like about these guys, like, as a team, George, Lenny, and you?
They play their ass off. That's what I like about them. And every night there's something new. They're constantly exploring, and they have great minds and extraordinary talent. And the great thing about playing together over a period of time is you really you get to know each other, and a trust is born, and that trust opens many doors. That trust opens ourselves to explore many new opportunities and not be trapped in any certain way or given way of doing things, always creating a new adventure.
And I would imagine that having a long association with those guys, when you're writing for a record like this new record, you sort of have those guys' voices in your head when you're composing.
Yeah, when I'm writing, I can hear each one of them. And I can write to fit their personalities. I can write to fit their expression.
That's what the story says. You know, the stories are about Ellington was that he didn't write a trumpet part. He wrote a part for a particular trumpet player.
Exactly. That's exactly right. You know, and it's rare these days to have that kind of opportunity. You know, but it can't be understated, the value of it.
Now you and Steve and Lenny also did an album last year with Cyrus Chestnut on piano, and guys did a trio record with him. So there were like two sort of back to back.
Yeah, with the two trio records. But the last record has Steve Nelson on it, not Steve Wilson.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But how would you characterize Cyrus Chestnut as a player compared with George Colligan? Because they seem like very different.
I don't compare players.
They seem
Cyrus
very different
Chestnut,
to me. Yeah.
Yes, they are, because George is George and Cyrus is Cyrus.
So what do you key off of when you're playing with Cyrus?
You know, man, I've had a career that started in 1958. Since 1960, since my first trip on the road with Gene Ammons and Sonny Stitt, I played with so many great musicians. And they all bring something of their own to, you know, to the bandstand. They all bring something to make you think a little bit differently. So, you know, some guys you like to play with more than others, but a great musician is a great musician, and deserves to be enjoyed under based on his or her own merit. So I don't compare people. You know, I don't say, you know, for me to try and compare George and Cyrus, that's not only is that impossible to do, but it's unfair. And all I can say is I enjoy playing with both of them, and they are two totally unique voices, and that's what I look for. That's great. If I played with you tonight, and then I played with somebody else that sounds just like you, well, you know, I mean, that's not too exciting. I want to hear the different expressions, because it brings something different out of me. You know, when I play with Cyrus, it brings something different out of me than when I play with George.
So I kind of want to go back to the beginning and ask you about that a little bit, because you grew up in Camden, right?
Camden, New Jersey, yeah.
Yeah, and which has been one of the poorest towns in New Jersey for a long time. I mean, I'm calling you from Elizabeth, so I'm lifelong Jersey myself. So what was Camden like when you were a kid?
Camden was the whole world to me when I was a kid, you know. And Camden had two big businesses. It had Campbell Soup, and it had RCA Victor. And everybody worked. Everybody had a job. And everybody was I mean, from the youth right on to, you know, to the adults, there was an industrious kind of atmosphere. You know, my father made me a shoeshine box, and I took this shoeshine kit, and I had my own business, going around, you know, shining people's shoes. I'd go into bars and shine people's shoes, and made a good living. I knew how to collect newspapers and tie them up, and collect rags and take them to the junkyard every Saturday, and you know, get my money that would carry me through the next week. Always gave me money for, you know, to go to the movies, and, you know, and we had this thing called the Police Athletic League. And there was, you know, the YMCA, Young Men's Christian Association, and the YWCA, the Young Women's Christian Association. And these things supplied us with after-school activities. There was, you know, we didn't have to go out in the street, you know, and do dangerous things. Of course, we did, but you know, but we had activities that kept us busy. And I look at that as being so valuable in helping young minds really structure, you know, a good foundation on how to live in this world, and how to how to be self-reliant. And that's one of the things that's sort of missing these days. So I didn't see, you know, our family as being poor. I didn't see Camden as being poor. It was a richer existence to me. You know, of course, you know, I mean, when you evaluate things on a national level and you talk about the gross national product, you know, Camden didn't stand out too good. But the, you know, the crime rate when I was coming up was not nearly what it became after I became grown and left.
Yeah.
You know, because you know, and also in school, you know, we had cultural programs. We learned music in school. We had a band, and you know, and every weekend there was a dance. The school had a dance. So, you know, we learned how to socialize with one another. We had the, you know, culture really incorporated into our, you know, academic structure. So there was nothing missing. There was nothing missing. All of that is missing now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Was that where you picked up the bass, was in school?
Well, actually, my father, I picked up the bass from my father. You know, when I grew up, I can't remember when I didn't hear music in the house. My father played the bass, my father played drums, and he played the piano.
Mm-hmm.
But his prize instrument was the bass. That was his real love. And so he taught me a little drums, he taught me piano. But I really keyed in on the bass. So, and then there was, you know, and at school I had the opportunity to play the bass in the orchestra. I remember my orchestra teacher named Mr. Minicozzi. And so we had orchestra rehearsals every week. So with my lessons at home and my applications, you know, in the orchestra, it was rich. It was rich. So when I graduated from high school, I think the month after I graduated from high school, I went out on the road with Gene Ammons and Sonny Stitt.
Right.
I had been prepared, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'd been prepared.
Yeah, and you did two albums with them in 61. Those were your first studio dates, right?
Yeah, I think Boss Tenors,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know, I forget the name of the other one. What was the name of the other one?
I'm trying to remember myself, yeah. But so you were in Chicago on the road with them, and they went into the studio?
We left Philadelphia, and we went into the studio. So I guess this was 61, yeah.
Yeah.
We left Philadelphia, and we went to Chicago. And I think as soon as we got to Chicago, we went into the studio. I had never been in a studio before.
Mm-hmm.
Here I am in the studio making a record with these guys that I had dreamt about. You know, it was it was extraordinary.
And it took you a few years before you made it back into the studio, because it seemed like throughout the 60s you were mostly on the road. So who were you playing with between, you know, 61 and, like, let's say 67, 68, when you were recording more?
Oh, I made records before that. You got to look more closely at my discography.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You know, because I left when I left Gene Ammons and Sonny Stitt, I think in 62 or 63, I went with Betty Carter. I recorded with Betty Carter. Oh, and I went with Dakota Staton. The strange thing about this Dakota Staton, while I was with Dakota Staton, she made many records, but she never used her trio.
Huh.
She always went into the studio and made records with, you know, the studio musicians. I didn't know how things worked in those days, but I thought it was strange that you know, we're playing together night after night, and she goes into the studio and makes a record, you know, and leaves us out of it.
Yeah.
But that was not the case, you know, when I left Dakota State and went with Betty Carter. And, you know, I recorded with Betty Carter. Then I went with Sarah Vaughan. I recorded with Sarah Vaughan. And I left Sarah Vaughan. I went with Nancy Wilson. I recorded with Nancy Wilson. And all during that time also, I was recording I forget some of the records I made then. But, of course, you know, building my name became more and more popular. I became more and more known, so I got to record with more and more people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because you were working with, like, one singer after another, so were they kind of recommending you to each other, or how did that, you know, how did you get...
I think there was a secret society going on. You know, because, you know, all great singers like good bass players. That's what that was a stream that I heard from all of these singers that I worked with. They listened to the bass player. I know that I remember being in Las Vegas with Nancy Wilson, and we were in Las Vegas. You know, we'd go to Las Vegas and we'd stay for a month. And Sammy Davis Jr. was working in one of the clubs at the same time. I think he was working over in Lake Tahoe. And we would get off our job and we would go over and hang out with Sammy Davis Jr. And he was always trying to get me to leave Nancy and join him. I remember one time, you know, we're at Sammy Davis's house. They always gave him a house over in Lake Tahoe in the lake, and his entourage, and you know, the chefs would always fix us meals. You know, this is late at night after we finished working. And I remember Nancy sort of like collared Sammy Davis and had him up against the wall and said, "Look, you leave my bass player alone. You know, stop trying to get busted and trying to leave me." Because Sammy used to take me into his closet. He had this big closet, was like big as a living room. And he had all of these suits and all of these shoes and all of these clothes, and we were about the same size, and he would always take me in and let me pick out stuff that I liked. And I never left his house without a handful of clothes, suits, jackets. And so the singers, they all liked good bass players.
That's really interesting, because I would assume that they would be keying off the piano player, but I guess it makes sense that you want that foundation so that you
Now the piano player is an accompanist, and not all great piano players are good accompanists or singers.
Mm-hmm.
There was this piano player named Jimmy Jones. Sarah loved him. Carmen loved him. Jimmy Jones, you know, that was not a household name, but he was so important to all of these singers. You know, so they listened to the piano player. You know, the piano player is you know, this, the timely, he must comp in a timely fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And complement what the singer is doing, and really have a kind of a deep empathy to not get in the way and to come in to make his little statements just at the right moment. But the bass player has he has the most important note in all of the piano player's harmony, and that is the root.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a piano player may be, you know, get a little complicated in his phrasing or in his harmonies, but if you never lose, if the bass player is always in the right place and playing the right note, the singer has always got that foundation that she needs.
Now you worked with Miles Davis a little in 67, mostly on the road, I imagine, but you did go into the studio for one session. Was there ever a serious question in your mind of replacing Ron Carter in that band, or did you just know that you were there, you know, because Ron couldn't make the gig, or, you know, what was going on there?
Well, actually, Miles asked me to stay in the band, but it was it just happened at the wrong time. I was with Nancy. Every year we got an itinerary for the whole year at the beginning of the year. Plus, Nancy had me on retainer. So while I was working with Miles, Nancy was still paying me every week.
Okay, yeah.
And I had a house in Granada Hills, and I had a yellow Stingray Corvette, and I was making good money, you know, with Nancy. So when I joined Miles, Nancy had taken a 5-week hiatus, and so I joined Miles for these 5 weeks, and during that time he asked me to, you know, would I stay with the band. It was a hard decision, but I mean, you know, it was hard to give up all of this security and comfort that I had. Plus, you know, I was still playing with everybody, you know, and I had a trio with Hampton Halls and Donna Bailey and whoever. And plus, I was with the Jazz Crusaders.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with my stability gig with Nancy Wilson. So to give all of that up and join Miles was kind of a hard thing to do. You know, but I have to tell you, though, I mean, I love playing with Miles. It was an experience like none other.
Mm-hmm.
And Miles was so, he was so accepting of your ideas. He never told me what to do. He never told me what to play. And he always complimented me and made it known that he loved he loved my playing. And so there was never any strain with him. It was just, my goodness, I'm playing with someone who not only accepts what I want to do, but compliments and gives me a new way of seeing things every single night.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a great experience.
Yeah. Now, between Nancy Wilson and Miles Davis and the Jazz Crusaders, were all those groups at that time attracting the same audience, or were they all different audiences in your mind?
I don't know what you mean by same or difference. What's the difference between the same audience and the different audience? You mean the same people?
Yeah. Did you have the same, you know, were you playing the same clubs with all three acts? Were you playing different, you know, different places and seeing different people, you know, stuff like that? Because I don't know what jazz scene was like in the 60s. I only know what it's like now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, I mean, there were a lot more venues than there are now. But there, you know, there's a, you know, a jazz venue, and then there's a cabaret venue, you know, and there's a... So I can say this. Nancy Wilson, at that time, we were doing more... things like the Flamingo in Las Vegas, or the Copacabana, or big halls where you wouldn't, they weren't classified as jazz venues, but how can I say, like the Coconut Grove in Los Angeles. I mean, you know, people like Tony Bennett and Frank Sinatra and Johnny Mathis, you know, these kind of people played these venues.
Mm-hmm.
So now, and in the jazz clubs, just, you know, like we played Shelley's Manhole.
Mm-hmm.
Every jazz group would come to Los Angeles and play Shelley's. What was the place we had out on Redondo Beach?
Was that the Lighthouse?
The Lighthouse.
Uh-huh.
Every top group would come and play the Lighthouse. So in that sense, being with the Jazz Crusaders or when Eddie Lockjaw Davis and Harry Sweets Edison would come to town, and you know, I would play these venues with them. Miles played the same venues. So in that sense, you know, if you mean same audience, I would say same venues, because, you know, I never, you know, I mean, there were certain people that you would see mm-hmm. all the time, but, you know, you always had new people.
Yeah, yeah. And then it was about 1969 when you started working in, 68, 69, when you started working in Herbie Hancock's groups, right?
Now, I had been with Nancy, I had joined Nancy in 65. And that's when I moved out to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved out to Los Angeles because she was moving her operation out to California. And I got married around the same time. And she was she was my wife's bridesmaid. And as a wedding gift, she moved us out to Los Angeles.
Wow.
So I stayed out there and until the end of 68, we were coming back to New York to work the Copacabana.
Mm-hmm.
And so I planned and made the plan that, you know, this would be my trip back to New York this time, and this time I'm going to stay. So my wife and I had all of our stuff brought back, you know, by Mayflower from Los Angeles to New York. And we found an apartment. And that's when Paul Chambers passed away. And Jimmy Cobb called me, and I joined Jimmy Cobb and Whitten Kelly. Took Paul Chambers' place in that trio.
Huh.
And I started, and then I and also joined Art Blakey and McCoy Tyner and Sonny Rollins and also Herbie Mann. So all of this was happening around that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1969, Herbie, and this happened. So when I came back to we're playing the Copa, this is the end of 68, and Herbie had just formed this band, and he was playing his first gig at the Village Vanguard. And Mickey Roker was the drummer in our trio with Nancy Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And Nancy, we always had the trio, but we would augment it with the big orchestra everywhere we went. And so we would play our show at the Copa, and then we would run over to the Vanguard and catch Herbie's first set. And Ron Carter had asked me to fill in for him at, with Herbie to play the first set because he was doing a Broadway show. So we run over there, and I play the first set for Ron, and then get back to the Copa to play our, I think we had our second show. And so when the gig was over at the Vanguard, you know, Herbie was, you know, the band was getting ready to go out and go out on the road. And by that time, you know, I had really formed a relationship with Herbie. And of course, we had played together, you know, with Miles. And I knew everybody. And, the, you know, Garnett Brown was on trombone. I think Johnny Coles was on trumpet. And Joe Henderson was on tenor.
Yeah.
And Pete LaRocca was actually playing drums, but at the end of that week, Tootie Heath went out with us. And so Ron, you know, wanted to stay in New York. So naturally now I'm with Herbie Hancock. And at the same time I had the gig with Herbie Hancock, I became a member of the Jazz Messengers with Art Blakey. And also a member of Herbie Mann's group. And everything was sort of working out for a while, kept me busy, and, you know. But then it occurred that everybody had a gig at the same time, and I had to choose who I was going to work with. And the most exciting band was you know, this sextet we had with Herbie. But it paid the least amount of money.
Isn't that always the way?
Yes. So, but it was no question what I wanted to do. I stayed with Herbie. And we stayed together till 1973.
Yeah, you were the only one from those bands, from Fat Albert Rotunda and The Prisoner, who also moved on with him to join Mwandishi.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then we got back together as a trio, Herbie and Al Foster and myself, in the early 80s.
I'm curious about this album that you did with that was originally released under Tootie Heath's name, Kawaida, from 1970.
Kawaida.
Yeah.
And M. Toomey was on that. Now, M. Toomey is actually Tootie Heath's nephew. M. Toomey is Jimmy Heath's son. And Kawaida, I think it was called.
Yeah.
And there was this club in Brooklyn called the East or something like that. And so I forget how it came about that Herbie, that Tootie had this date, but M. Toomey was part of the reason why this date came about. And I think Don Cherry was on it. And so it was sort of an expression of, you know, we were, you know, civil rights movements were rife then, you know. And M. Toomey was part of this organization called the US organization, and of course the Black Panthers were strong. And we did this album, Kawaida, Is that how you pronounce it?
I assume so. Yeah, that looks right.
Yeah. And it was all about Ron Karenga, who was the head of the US organization, and he had started this thing called Kwanzaa, which is the Black celebration, you know, of the holidays. Well, the Kwanzaa was, you know, had these seven principles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I forget all these principles, what they were, but it was all about, you know, living a life of dignity and justice and fairness and peace among people. It was
yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. There's like a recitation on the record, I think.
Yeah. So that was a very, I think it was a very important album that we did. And it was really an expression of Black unity, you know, and sort of like the living together, you know, of all of us, regardless of race and creed, nationality.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of us were in there with Herbie and Tootie and Jimmy Heath was in that too, I believe, right?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious also about your time with Mwandishi, because I love those records, and I also love the records that some of the guys in the band made, like the Eddie Henderson albums and Benny Maupin's album, that are basically mm-hmm. Mwandishi albums with maybe one person missing. Like, I think Julian Priester usually was not on those records,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so, I mean, what are your memories of those couple of years, like 70 to 73, when you guys were doing all that stuff?
Oh, man, it was such an important time. All of us that came out of that, that time really shaped our perception for the whole future, I believe, and including Herbie, you know. And at the same time, rather than try and repeat history, it gave us the confidence to go on and continue to treat each new day as a new day, you know, and also how to appreciate what has brought us to this new day. So it was a very creative time. And very challenging, because somehow we couldn't accept tonight's performance being a repeat of last night's performance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As great as last night's performance might have been, you know, I mean, we had many nights where we thought, my goodness, you know, I've never played this, it's never sounded this good, you know. But the next night, you know, as much as you held on to that elite moment, you couldn't accept tonight being like last night. You wanted to be another elite moment.
Yeah.
You know, so those years were exciting. And, you know, When you're living history, you don't know you're making history. I mean, you're just living in the moment and striving to create something that's totally, you know, without an agenda and totally unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, you don't go in and say, okay, I'm going to do this, what I'm going to do tonight, and it's going to create history. You just, just say, you're just trying to, you know, you're just trying to answer the call, you know, that your heart is putting forth. And so then when it's over, you know, you look back on it and you know, you know that you're who you are because of that. You're who you are because of what you did and what you were able to be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then the validation of that is actually what you do from now on.
What I think is so interesting is I've heard live tapes of Mwandishi's shows where you guys would play a tune for 40, 45 minutes sometimes, you know, and yeah. Was the audience with you? Were people
always,
you know?
Man, it was incredible. The audience was always with us. You know, audience don't have that kind of mind span, or, you know, attention span these days, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was what was so beautiful. It was a journey that we all took together, and we used to talk about, you know, we wanted to see, you know, the audience levitate. people used to tell us, man, we saw you, you know, you guys levitated off of the ground, and we had many experiences. I mean, you know, we would finish a performance and people would come and try and express what they felt, you know, but then nothing expressed it like the tears in their eyes. I mean, we experienced things that I've never experienced since. That band was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
It was extraordinary. And how it took the people with us was, I mean, you're talking about 45 minutes. I remember, you know, we might play an introduction. You know, we all had, you know, like bamboo flutes, or, you know, tambourines, or, you know, a cowbell, or, you know, some kind of sticks or stuff. And we'd play all of this stuff before we even played a note. And that would go on sometimes for 20, 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And you know, and the people were right there with us. It was like they were absorbed. And I've never seen anything like it before or since.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And after that, you made your first solo record. You did Pinnacle in 75, which was a really interesting record because it kind of combines, you know, there's jazz, there's fusion, there's almost R&B type of stuff. It's like a really interesting blend. So what were you thinking going into that record?
Well, you know, I had started writing. Actually, I started writing when I was with the Jazz Crusaders, and that's the first time I recorded Firewater, and we also recorded a thing I did called the Ruby Begonia, Native Dancer.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz Crusader recorded these tunes, and so in 1975, I had this opportunity to make my first record as a leader. And I had written this thing called The Hump. And I remember we put that on the record. And Guillermo Franco, guy from Brazil, I really liked him. I had heard him with McCoy. He played all these percussion instruments. He was on the record with me, I think. And I had Woody Shaw, and Onaji, Alan Gums,
mm-hmm.
Billy Hart, and I never think about themes, except that sometimes, many times it seems like when it's all put together, there is a theme to it. And, but, writing to me is all about in the moment. I can't, it's hard for me to sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write this kind of song.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I have to write that kind of song, but what comes out of many different things before I finally get to that kind of song,
Yeah.
So I can't say that I had any particular agenda in mind for that album, Pinnacle. I look back at it and I say, the nerve of me, calling my first solo date, or my first date as a leader, Pinnacle. My goodness, Pinnacle comes after any trials and tribulations, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's what came to me. And other than the mix of that, I liked the music on that record. I didn't like the mix too well. But, it's a funny thing. I do a record, and then it's the hardest thing for me to listen to it. Because, it's over, and what that record has told me is what I can do better.
Mm.
So it's hard for me to get stuck on it.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I did this record, Something More, I had been toying with the idea, and many people have been telling me, man, you should get your own band. But my idea of having a band was creating, having an identity and a brand. And in order to have an identity and a brand, for me, I had to get to where I enjoyed playing what I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And up to that time, I didn't feel like I can play a whole gig of my music.
See, that's kind of what I wanted to talk to you about, because you've written a lot of tunes. But I don't get the feeling that you think of yourself as a lead bassist like Charles Mingus, I feel like you prefer to be the foundation, which is why you were talking about working with all these different singers and being, providing that root note for someone else, stuff mm-hmm. like that. I feel like you're that kind of guy, and I'm curious, how you feel about it.
Well, I don't write music to feature me. I write music to feature the band.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the band sound, and I might do something, in the course of a performance, a set, I play a solo piece on my own, but I enjoy making a band sound good. I enjoy that. Mm-hmm. And I have no trepidation or misunderstanding of what my role is. And I enjoy that. I enjoy making a band sound good. I enjoy, giving a piano player the freedom to experiment with his voicings.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy making a drummer feel free to play what he wants to play. So, and when I write, I'm not writing necessarily with how this is going to feature me. I'm writing with how this is going to feature the band.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it goes back to what we said at the outset, you know, having these guys that I play with, I can hear that that's an inspiration also for what I write. Because I know Steve, I know Lenny, and I know George. Now, of course, I'm not going to be, you know, playing with them necessarily all my life, and they're not the only guys that I play with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then I might write something where I'm not hearing anybody particular, but I'm hearing a certain sound. I'm hearing an idea. And I never know what it's going to be. It starts to take shape, you know. This leads to this, and this leads to this, and this leads to this.
Yeah.
Then I might step back away from it and say, you know, and then come back to it and find something that fits before all of that. And what I had written yesterday is something that occurs in the middle. You know,
mm-hmm.
And you know what I want to do is, and it's kind of hard to do it on a record though, but I want to write a suite of music that lasts for about an hour with no interruptions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of hard to do that on the record, you know, the records, like, you know, like the, you know, one tune after another, but I'm gonna do that.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So I'm trying to prepare my head for the next record, and you know, but it's a challenge also to not be too hard on myself, because I don't want to repeat anything. And you know, and I have to, you know, I can't fool myself, you know. I mean, I don't like everything that I do. And you know, and I know that nothing that I do is finished. You know, so, but that's good, because it keeps me on my toes and it keeps me looking ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I want to ask about a couple of guys that you played with in the 70s and 80s particularly. Especially, I wanted to know about working with Woody Shaw, because when a band is taking sort of hard bop related music into such a kind of an advanced area, how does that change your role as the bassist? What are you doing in a band like that?
Well, first of all, Woody Shaw was an exceptional musician. No trumpet player before or after was like Woody Shaw. He was very special. And you see, I had my roots, and I never want to separate myself from my roots, because, I mean, if that's the case, then I'm rootless, and nothing's worse than, you know, a rootless plant or a rootless, you know, artist. You've mm-hmm. got to have some roots. And if your connection to these roots makes you feel stifled, well, then you're not giving these roots the proper respect. These roots are the reason why, you know, you can create such prolific branches. And there's a saying, you know, the further the source, the longer the stream. You know, so, or the you know, and the deeper the roots, the more prolific the branches.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, when you talk about hard bop or bebop or whatever expression you want to use, all of that's a jump off point. And all of that is not only the reason why you can do what you can do, but also the source of your inspiration. You know, yesterday was important, and the great importance of yesterday was that it brought about today. Now, I don't care how great yesterday was. I can't, you know, if you know, I can't live in yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I had a beautiful calendar of last year, but last year's calendar is always going to be one day off for this year. So what can you do new? What can you do new? And you don't have to throw out, you know, what they say, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to throw away yesterday to create something new today. In fact, today's relevance, you know, what validates today is your connection to yesterday. You know, if you know, and it gives meaning. So I can and what's the most important when I write is that it makes me feel good, that I like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I'm writing for. I'm writing something that I like.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've been able to do is the ladder or the rungs of the ladder that allows me to take another step. Am I making any sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And
so so the only trap is when you don't have like-minded people in your sphere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so sometimes, you know, you have to make adjustments, you know, because, you know, to have, because you need like-minded people to, you know, or at least people with an open mind to be willing to hear or try and envision a new way.
Mm-hmm. You used the word sphere just now, and I'm curious about your time in that band, Sphere, because I don't think you ever played with Thelonious Monk, right? So,
no, I never played with Thelonious Monk.
So in what ways did that band sort of function as like a learning experience for you, or in what ways did his music speak to you when you were playing it with those guys?
Well, Monk's music is unique. You know, the Monk's music has something that no other music has. It's hard to play Monk's music without Monk in mind. You know,
mm-hmm.
you listen to a piano player try and play "Well, You Needn't" or any of Monk's tunes, and you'll always hear some of Monk in that piano player, because his music was so much of the way he played. So that's a challenge. Now, the Sphere, the trio, Kenny Bannon, Ben Raleigh, we had been together with Ron Carter. And Kenny and I had known each other since, you know, our early days in Philadelphia. And so that trio, I mean, there was never any kind of effort put forth for that trio to swing. that trio just swung. As soon as we looked at each other, and it would start swinging. So, and then Charlie Rouse was a great addition because Charlie Rouse was, he was a different kind of saxophone player. He didn't play a whole bunch of notes. He nobody had a swing like him. Nobody had a feel like him. And we got together and decided we wanted to make a record of Monk's music, not to be a Monk tribute band, but Monk had retired to his room over at Nika Koningsworth's home and refused to come out. And he was ill, and we wanted to make a record of his music and present it to him as our gift, and also to him and Nellie, his wife. And we did research on all of the tunes that we wanted to play on this first record to make sure that they were in his publishing company, because you'd be surprised how many tunes that Monk wrote, or a lot of guys in those days, and they didn't get the publishing rights. So that's what we did. But when we went into the studio over at Rudy Van Gelder's in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and we recorded this album, which turned out to be 4-in-1. When we came out of the studio on the way back to New York, we heard on the radio that Monk had died. So when the album came out, of course, it was labeled, by not us, but by the media as a tribute to Monk. And that label stuck with us throughout the life of Sphere. And trying to live that label down, we deliberately didn't record more than one or two Monk's tunes on our subsequent releases. And the title Sphere of the band was an expression of what we wanted to do as a unit, in other words, the sphere of music that we wanted to cover. And for example, Ben's tunes, Charlie's tunes, Kenny's tunes, my tunes. And but it became, it was always labeled with Monk.
What you were saying about Charlie Rouse reminded me that you also played with Dexter Gordon in the 70s. And I'm wondering, was he that same kind of traditional old school player, but or was he, stretching out in those years as well? Because I know Woody was in his band for a while as well, and so,
Nobody stretched more than Dexter. Dexter could play a solo. He'd play you 30 courses and never repeat himself. And never clutter it up with a bunch of notes. He was the master of phrasing, just like Miles Davis, just like J.J. Johnson. It takes fearlessness to phrase. It doesn't take too much, other than, your ability to play the instrument, which we call technique, to play a whole bunch of notes. But to phrase, to take 10 notes and then play the five most essential notes. Barry Harris is a master of that. Ahmad Jamal is a master of that. Miles is a master of that, So, and that's what Dexter, that's who Dexter was. He was a most interesting player.
Do you think that that's something that you strive for as well as a bassist?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I want to play those notes that bring out the beauty of the music. I want to play those notes that bring out the beauty of the harmony. You know, it to play all of the notes just to make sure that you don't miss something. You know, it's like, you know, well, let me just say everything that I know how to say, and then you pick out, you know, what makes sense to you, rather than having the courage, you know, to get to enunciate or to express the real meaning. You see, and I say courage because when you do that, then, you know, there's nothing to fall back on. You know, well, I don't know whether the A flat or the A or the B flat is going to work best, so I better play all three of them. You know, rather than say no, I'm just going to play this A. You know, and it's and you're going, wow, yes, that's the note, that's the one.
Okay, that was my interview with Buster Williams, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast, which is part of the Osiris Podcast Network. Visit osirispod.com to learn more about all the different shows they host. And as I said up top, if you enjoy this podcast, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. I thank you for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.
Osiris.